evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom declared that California needs 3.5 million additional homes built by 2025. Despite a flurry of housing-related bills signed into law in 2019 and millions of dollars in donations from tech giants like Google, Facebook, and Apple, the state is still not on track to meet this ambitious goal. So tonight, we're asking one of the Bay Area's state legislators how he is approaching California's housing crunch in 2020. What new bills will pave the way for more housing? What are the roadblocks? And what about related issues such as homelessness and safe injection sites? Tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by California State Senator Scott Wiener, Democratic member of the California State Senate, representing the 11th District, which includes San Francisco and parts of San Mateo County. And before that, he was a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Welcome back to City Vision, Senator Scott Wiener.
Thank you for having me.
And in about 20 minutes, we'll invite you, the listeners, to join the conversation. The number to call with your questions or comments is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. Well, Senator Wiener, let's start with a bit of a retrospective. What happened in 2019's legislative session? What were some of the big wins, as you saw them, for housing in California?
Yeah, well, 2019 saw some significant wins for housing. Certainly not the complete victory that we all want, but we took some significant strides. We passed a bill by Senator Nancy Skinner, Senate Bill 330, that helps streamline the approval process for housing, makes it harder for cities to avoid following their own rules, limits the number of endless hearings that you can have on housing, and cracks down on some other abuses that some cities use to stymie housing production. We also passed Assembly Bill 1482 by Assembly Member David Chu of San Francisco, my Assembly member, which places a statewide rent cap protecting renters and statewide just cause eviction protections for renters. That's a bill that 5 years ago would never have made it out of a single committee, and it was signed into law last year, showing how bad the housing crisis is and how the politics are shifting. And then we also passed some significant legislation to ensure that cities are allowing people to put accessory dwelling units called ADUs, also known as in-law units, in their homes or buildings, a way of sort of carving out existing space on property in buildings to create these secondary units. There were some other wins as well, but those were a few of the big ones.
So you mentioned just now then bills on reforming local permitting processes, rent control, accessory dwelling units. One issue you didn't mention, and this is a subject of your Senate Bill 50, so I want to give you a chance to talk about it, is local zoning. It's the local codes that prevent new housing from coming in, and particularly around some of our major transit stops and near our big job centers. And your bill, Senate Bill 50, I want to let you describe it, but it was shelved last year and is now in play this year. But can you describe what happened last year and a little bit just introduce the bill as well for listeners?
Sure. So Senate Bill 50, or SB 50, is legislation that will legalize apartment buildings and affordable housing, in other words, legalize more housing and denser housing near public transportation and near job centers. We have a 3.5 million home shortage in California. We rank 49 out of 50 states in homes per capita. And over the last 60 years, while California's population has almost tripled, our housing production has gone down by about 70%. So any way you slice it with the numbers, we are far, far, far behind in just the number of homes that we need in California at all income levels. Every kind of housing, we're behind. And what we want to make sure, and the governor has committed, and we all are, you know, want to build millions of new homes to make sure that people can afford to live here and people aren't living in their cars and kids can come back from college and make a life in the community where they grew up and young families aren't being pushed out and so on and so forth. We want those homes. But what we don't want to do is build more sprawl because we've made it so hard to build homes in the job centers near where the transit is in places like the Bay Area or parts of L.A. That people just build further out, cover up farmland, clog up the freeways, push people into two-hour super commutes, increase carbon emissions, and sprawl is not sustainable. But the only way to avoid sprawl while we build housing is to have more density around transit and in job centers. And so what SB 50 does is it sets basic standards for cities to say that in these areas near the jobs and the transit, you can't zone only for single-family homes. You can't do low-density zoning. You have to allow higher-density zoning, small to mid-size apartment buildings and affordable housing. And so it overrides local restrictive zoning in these areas, and that's controversial because historically cities have set their own zoning, and the state hasn't interfered very much. But look where it's gotten us. And the bill has very strong tenant protections in it. What we don't want to do is encourage building new housing at the expense of existing housing. In other words, we don't want to have lots of demolition and evictions of tenants. This is about adding housing, not replacing people who live in a community. We have an affordability requirement, and we have a delayed implementation in so-called sensitive communities with significant concentrations of low-income residents, risk of displacement. And then finally, a recent amendment we put in gives cities more flexibility in how they implement the legislation. They get a couple years to formulate their own alternative plan that accomplishes the goals of the bill but does it in a unique way for that city. So that's the bill. We introduced it last year. There was a previous bill the year before that was similar, so this is really, we're now in the third year of this legislation, and we were prepared to bring it to a vote in the full Senate last May after having been passed out of two committees, and then it was made into what we call a two-year bill, so it got delayed until January this month. And so now we're back, and we're working to try to pass it out of the Senate.
So I definitely want to ask you about what the current effort involves to get it passed this month out of the House of Origin, out of the state Senate. But I have to ask you, since you did mention this is really take three of this bill. It was held up last year. It was a predecessor bill before that. What's the journey been like of this bill? What kind of opposition have you encountered in it? What are some of those key changes? What have you learned through this process that maybe if you could go back in time, you might have told 2018 version of you some lessons learned?
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon when you're doing a hard, impactful bill that's controversial, that makes serious change. It's not uncommon that it takes multiple years. There are bills that have been around far longer than 3 years, that's fine. I mean, this is a huge state. It's a complicated and diverse state. We want to get things right, and so there's nothing wrong with taking some more time. And although we all want to get things done yesterday, and I certainly am the same way, sometimes you gotta sort of take a deep breath and take another run at it. When I first introduced the original version of this bill in January of 2018, I knew at the time that it was going to be a controversial and hard bill. But there are quite a few controversial and hard bills at any given time in the legislature. There's nothing uncommon about that. I did not anticipate how in the public eye this bill would be, how deeply ingrained in political conversations it would be. Within a few months of introducing that bill in early 2018, people were stopping me on the street to talk about the bill, and they knew the bill number. And usually people don't know the bill number unless they're working in the legislature. People would tell me, hey, I was just down, you know, in Orange County having, you know, with family, and we're having dinner, and my parents brought the bill up. And so that was just within a few months of introducing it. It really set off a storm with enormous support and excitement for the bill, for people who were saying, finally, we can make a big move on housing, but also intense pushback by people who didn't like it for various reasons. So there was a real intensity that has remained around the bill. And frankly, even though it has been challenging at times, and there are people who, you know, say a lot of things online about me, and, you know, there have been some protests, and that's never easy, I'm actually really happy that we were able to at least help to elevate the conversation around housing and to really get people to think, okay, when I get upset about the cost of housing, when I'm mad that someone's getting evicted or that someone can't find housing or that I can't find housing, when I say I want housing to be more affordable, what exactly do I mean by that? Does it mean I'm just going to get mad and pray and get angry enough that the cost will come down? Or does it mean that we're going to make the hard choices that we need to make for that to happen? And so it's been a real learning experience. I mean, on the positive side, the coalition behind this bill is absolutely massive. It is a hugely diverse coalition of, you know, labor and business working together, developers and the building trades working together. We have major environmental groups supporting the bill. Groups like AARP and Habitat for Humanity and the UC Students Association and United Way of California, United Farm Workers, you know, all the Coalition for Clean Air, all supporting this bill. We have more and more cities and counties that are endorsing it, not a majority. It's a smaller number, but it's growing. And we have, at this point, probably about 50 local elected officials in California who are supporting it. It's a growing number. So it's a really inspiring coalition, and this coalition now tends to back a lot of different housing bills, and that's very inspiring. The opposition is also fierce. It falls into a few categories. There are straight-up people who don't want to see any growth, you know, sort of the not-in-my-backyard NIMBY attitude, who are just against development in their community, and they don't want anything to change, and they will fight any change. Then there are cities that may be open to housing, but they don't want the state to tell them what to do. And as a former local elected official, I understand that, but, you know, it's a conversation we have to have. And then there are progressives who have concerns about displacement and gentrification, and I'm very sensitive to those concerns. I do not want to see people get evicted or housing demolished because of this bill, and that's why we've worked out strong protections to protect against that. But we're not all the way there yet, and we continue to work with a statewide network of housing equity advocates who, again, have concerns about the bill, but we have been methodically working out some issues and making progress on other issues, and I'm committed to finishing that work.
And I have to ask, is this a sort of first in the nation kind of a approach here to ending single family zoning or trying to around transit? Or did you have any and do you now have any models that you look to that maybe inspired your legislative approach?
Yeah, here? And I should say one thing I forgot to mention about the bill at the beginning, in addition to allowing small to mid-sized apartment buildings near jobs and transit, it also almost everywhere statewide would allow up to fourplex. So duplex, triplex, fourplex. So you could either build a 2-3-4 unit small building, or you could do an internal retrofit of a single family home to add additional units without tearing down the home. In terms of others, I think this would be the most far-reaching and aggressive that we've seen, but there are other states that have done really strong work in this area. So Oregon recently ended single family zoning, allowing up to fourplex statewide. And then Minneapolis ended single family zoning last year. I think they went up to triplex, if I'm recalling correctly. And there have been proposals in other states as well. So I think increasingly people are starting to realize that although you know, we've gotten used to a certain way of living, and a lot of people wanting, you know, a single family home and a yard in a community where the only housing there are other single family homes, that is no longer tenable. And single family homes are great. I grew up in one. There's always going to be a strong place for single family homes, and this is not about eliminating single family homes or banning them or stopping people from living in them, but it's about acknowledging that we can't limit our housing stock to single family homes, because it puts a mathematical cap on the amount of housing you can build without sprawling, one unit per parcel, and it ends up becoming, at times, it can become a little bit out of reach for most people, because when you look in communities in the Bay Area now, what single family homes are selling for, people complain about the cost of condos. Everything is too expensive now, whether it's a new condo, whether it's a 100-year-old condo, everything is expensive. But single family homes are in a class by themselves, and there are many communities in the Bay Area where the average single family home is going for $1 million or $1.5 million or $2 million, and that is not attainable by the vast majority of people, and so it's just not sustainable to mandate that the only kind of housing you can build are single family homes.
Well, and you mentioned the fourplex provision that essentially any home, if I understand it correctly, could be subdivided into a fourplex. And that is actually potentially, I would think, more transformative and more impactful to Californians than provisions that are, you know, limiting this this upzoning to just around transit stops, which is a relatively small percentage of California's geography. But if we're now saying statewide, any home can now become up to a fourplex, that seems like that could really change neighborhoods. And, you know, to your point about limiting sprawl, is there a concern that you might see then more people living farther and farther out in fourplexes and some of these ex-urban areas commuting in? Could that undermine the environmental goals in the
bill? I think that the point of the transit and job accessible, you know, smaller to mid-sized apartment buildings, I think are over time will be very impactful because you can put, you know, more concentrated housing there, and that's very important. But the point of the fourplex was to have lighter touch in other areas, and to acknowledge that we're not, you know, we're not going to just like all of a sudden like concentrate everyone into the job and transit areas. People live all over California, and people are suffering with the cost of housing all over California. And if you have a community that isn't a job center, doesn't have transit, but has a whole bunch of people there who are struggling with housing, why not allow someone, if they have, let's say they have a large home, which could be subdivided internally into like 3 units or maybe 4 units if it's big enough, why not allow them to do that? And so it's sort of a way of striking a balance, acknowledging that not everyone is going to live in a job center and near transit, and we have to account for that too in a lighter touch way.
Well, then another aspect of the bill that you mentioned is that there's also provisions to upzone in jobs-rich areas, and that's undefined. And then also you mentioned that so-called sensitive communities at risk of gentrification and displacement are essentially exempted from the bill for a period of time. But there's no definition for either of those terms, sensitive communities or job-rich communities. So for a voter, a member of the public looking at this bill, you know, how do they have any sense as to whether or not their neighborhood's going to be affected by the eventual definition of these terms and how they're applied?
Yeah, so there will be a process in the bill for how that – there's basically criteria in the bill for how that's determined. And one of the pieces of that we're still – working out with the advocacy community is the process for determining sensitive communities. We want to make sure we're protecting communities that have concentration of low-income residents and that are at risk of displacement without going broad so that communities get defined as sensitive communities when there are no such thing. You can imagine that there are some wealthy communities that will try to claim they are sensitive communities. There are maybe some cities that do have areas that we would call sensitive, but they might be overbroad about it. So we want to make sure we're not sweeping in areas that shouldn't be part of it. And so it is a sort of a complicated issue, but we're making some progress.
Well, politically, would it help the bill if there was more definition at this point to kind of reassure people if they're in or out of these communities?
I don't know. It could be a double-edged sword. I don't think that is not what's causing challenges for the bill at this point. It's really the broader issues that are the ones pushing back.
All right. Well, we still have more to talk about where it's at status-wise and some of the opposition and support that you've experienced with SB 50 or housing legislation. But I want to let listeners know that this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. And we're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're joined by State Senator Scott Wiener. He's a Democratic member of the California State Senate, representing the 11th District, which includes San Francisco and parts of San Mateo County. And he's talking to us tonight about housing legislation in Sacramento, statewide. What is the latest in terms of housing proposals this year? We're doing a bit of a retrospective on things that happened last year as well. We want to open the phone lines to you, the listeners, and hear from you. Do you have questions for State Senator Wiener? Do you have thoughts about what it's going to take to address the housing shortage and address the housing challenges that we're experiencing here in the Bay Area and statewide? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, we do have a tweet from Sarah M. who asks, does Senator Wiener live in a home zoned for single-family homes, and will the law apply to his own communities? She says her understanding is that many supporting this quote-unquote developer bonanza live in communities carefully exempted from it. So, Senator Wiener, what's your response to Sarah M. with that question?
I think that's when they say things like it's a developer bonanza or whatever. I mean, this is about having enough housing for everyone who needs it. And it's really easy just to say, oh, we hate developers and screw the developers and all that. But the reality is, I would ask for anyone who says that to go back and look at who built your home that you live in, whether it's an apartment building or single-family home or a condo. I'm willing to bet my lunch that it was a developer who built it at some point in time, whether it was a year ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago. We all overwhelmingly live in homes that were built by developers, and the developers probably made some money from building that home. But guess what? You get to live there now, and that's a good thing, and that's what we want. In terms of where I live, yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. I live in a 39-unit building. It is one block from Castro Muni Station, a subway station. My neighborhood would be significantly affected by the legislation. And in fact, the part of the Castro that I live in is zoned R3. That means that you can only build up to 3 units on a parcel. So it allows more than single family, but it allows a triplex, basically. And that R3 will be increased, depending on the size of the parcel, compared to what it is today. You'll have a lot more parcels where, if it becomes available at some point in the future, you might be able to build a 6, 8, or 10, or a bigger unit. I will say that the building, the 39-unit building I live in, and by the way, the square footage of my unit is 500 square feet. I don't have a lot of space, and that's okay. I don't need a lot of space. It was built in 1965 when it was still legal to build larger apartment buildings in the Castro and other parts of San Francisco. And then in the 1970s and 80s, San Francisco downzoned and banned buildings like mine and said you can only build, whether it's 3 units in my neighborhood, 2 units in a lot of areas, or single family. About 80% of San Francisco is zoned either single family, 2 units, or 3 units. So what we're really saying is let's go back to the way we used to do it before the 1970s and 1980s, when you had apartment buildings built all over the place before we banned them.
All right. So for Sarah M., Senator Wiener definitely is not exempting himself or his neighborhood from SB 50. So we can dispel that conspiracy theory or that myth right now. So let's go to the phone lines. We have Matt calling in from San Francisco. Matt, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you very much. My question was, I remember some years back, the Board of Supervisors voted to demolish Park Merced. And Park Merced has always been a kind of a community that allowed for kind of low and middle-income people to live there. And this was some years back. I don't remember all the details, but I remember a friend who lived there being very upset that the then-Supervisor Wiener had essentially voted in favor to demolish it, resulting in the displacement of many, many, you know, long-term residents in San Francisco. And I don't remember all the details, but there was some monkey business about violating the sunshine ordinance. And so it just seems the senator's, you know, talking about increasing housing, but I guess I'd like to give him this opportunity to address that. I remember there were a lot of charges of hypocrisy and that a lot of your funding came from developers, and that in your zeal to create new housing, you were displacing long-term residents. So could you address that, please, Mr. Wiener?
Right, okay, Matt, thank you for that question. So, yes, Senator Wiener, question on Park Merced. It's a big potential project in San Francisco, and I think maybe emblematic of some of the bigger projects around the Bay. What's your response to Matt?
Yeah, I'll answer the question as opposed to the speech that contained a number of very inaccurate statements. But yeah, I'm happy to refresh the memory of a caller about Park Merced. And by the way, Park Merced has not been demolished. The project, which the Board of Supervisors approved in 2012, and yes, I voted for the project. It was a good project, as did a majority of the Board of Supervisors, and the mayor signed it into law. And the supervisor who represented the district where Park Merced was the leading advocate for the project. What the Park Merced project that we approved was, is there are 1,500 units of housing that were built right after World War II. They were never intended to be sort of long-term permanent housing. It's not the best construction in the world. There are a lot of problems with it. And so what the developer had proposed was replacing those 1,500 units with 6,000 units of housing to reroute the light rail line right through the middle of this 6,000 units, so it would be the most transit accessible that you can imagine. In addition, those 1,500 units were rent-controlled housing, and so a deal was reached as part of this that of the 6,000 new units, 1,500 of them would be replacement units for those 1,500 demolished rent-controlled units that would be capped at the same rents and would be permanently rent-controlled. The residents of those 1,500 units would be able to move into these brand-new units that would be at least the same size and pay exactly the same rent they were paying for their old, deteriorated units. In addition, no one would move out of their units until the new unit was built. So the first phase would be building the units that would replace the existing units. People would remain living in their units. The new, brand new units would be built for the same rent, and then they could move from their old unit into the brand new unit for the same rent, and only then would the existing units, once they were vacated, be demolished. So that was what the project was, so that the caller did not say that. But to be clear, the project hasn't even started, so that to say that these units have been demolished and people displaced is false. The units are still there 8 years later. The residents are still living in those units. The project has been very, very slow moving forward. So
Do you know what's holding up the project, Senator Wiener?
You know, and there was a newspaper article in the Chronicle a couple weeks ago which addressed some of these issues. So we have a lot of these big mega projects in the Bay Area. Park Merced, we have the Treasure Island project, which is, I think, 8 or 10,000 units. the Candlestick Point, Hunters Point Shipyard project, which is 10,000 units, and so on and so forth. And these are big transformational projects. And in addition to the cost of construction, you're also creating new neighborhoods, effectively. You have to put all the infrastructure in, new roads, often new sewer lines, water lines, the power infrastructure. It's very, very complicated and big and expensive. And sometimes they move forward in an expeditious way, but sometimes it gets really bogged down and you have financial challenges, and so things are slow. And that's not to say we shouldn't do these big transformational projects, but what it also points out is we can't just rely on them. And that smaller infill projects, building that 6, 8, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100-unit building in an existing neighborhood where you can actually deliver the project in a few years, is also incredibly important.
All right, so maybe potentially another argument for the SB 50 type approach with some smaller projects. I want to thank Matt from San Francisco for that question. And I want to let listeners know this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about the housing crisis in California and right here in the Bay Area. And we're joined by our guest, State Senator Scott Wiener, Democratic member of the California State Senate, representing the 11th District, which includes San Francisco and parts of San Mateo County. And prior to that, he was a member of the Board of Supervisors, and that was just referencing some of the votes there with that Park Merced project. We want to hear from you to join the conversation. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. What are your questions for Senator Wiener about what California could be doing better to address the housing crisis here in the Bay Area and beyond? You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have Mark also calling from San Francisco. So welcome to City Visions, Mark.
Thank you. Hey, Scott, it's Mark Bruno. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And thanks for appearing on KLW, my favorite radio station. I listen to it all the time. So I live in San Francisco, as was just stated, and I know that Senator Wiener just made this dichotomy, which I find kind of a stretch, that those of us opposed to SB 50, as am I, as is everyone I know in North Beach in the Democratic Party, we're all opposed to it for one primary reason. The question is not about being against developers. Scott's correct. All of our apartment buildings, I live in one, they were built by developers. That's not the issue, Senator Wiener. The issue is, why do we have the need to have Sacramento imposed, or your planning projects, your ideal of planning imposed on us in the neighborhoods by Sacramento? Park Merced is an example, and many projects here are an example of neighborhoods having voices, building more housing constantly in San Francisco without SB 50. SB 50 is just a way of having Sacramento impose its ideas and taking out the neighborhood voice from the community projects. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark. And I think you're fitting into that bucket that Senator Wiener described of opposition based on the local control question. So, Senator Wiener, your thoughts and response to Mark.
Sure, absolutely. And you know, as I mentioned, I'm a former local elected official. And before that, I was president of my neighborhood association. So I'm very sensitive to the importance of local decision making in a lot of areas. And I do believe that local decision making, by and large, is usually leads to better results. So that's very real, and I don't dispute that. But that doesn't mean that local control is always the best way to go. And it certainly doesn't mean that California's version of extreme local control, which is what we have on housing, works. There's nothing in the Bible that says local control over housing is inherently better. Local control is a good thing when it delivers good results. It usually does deliver good results, but our system of extreme local control on housing in California has not delivered good results, and the proof is in the pudding. I mentioned the numbers at the beginning. 49 out of 50 states in homes per capita, multi-million home housing shortage, a complete collapse in housing production over the last 60 years as our population almost tripled. And so when you look at the actual results we have driven the car into a ditch because we have allowed each city in California to decide for themselves for many years with either no state laws or toothless state laws. They can decide for themselves, do we want to build housing? Or maybe we don't want to build any housing. If you don't want to build housing, no problem, go forward. Or only a little bit of housing. We're not going to allow any multi-unit. And when you ban multi-unit, you're banning affordable housing because no one's built a building affordable below market rate single-family homes. It has to be multi-unit. And so we've created a race to the bottom where cities have very little incentive to build any new housing. And even cities that want to build new housing will say, well, but my neighboring cities aren't going to build any, so why should I? And so what we've seen over the last few years, and it's not just SB 50, there have been a number of other laws as well, including laws putting teeth into state housing laws that have been on the books for decades, is a move not to end local control. No one is talking about ending local control. Some people might, but no one who's involved in these decisions. It's about rebalancing to say, let's have local control with state standards that govern those local decisions and that cabin them. And, you know, this is not unique to housing. We have public schools in California, and we have local school districts and school boards that make a lot of local decisions. But they don't do it in a vacuum. We don't say do whatever you want, decide whether how many days you're going to educate, what subjects, whether you hire credentialed teachers. We have an entire education code that sets parameters around that local control, and we can debate what should be in the education code, but I don't think there are that many people who would say, let's repeal the entire education code and have the Wild West when it comes to public education. Yet that is exactly what we've done with housing. We've had few or no state standards. We've allowed a race to the bottom by the cities, and while some cities have done a great job, many have not. And we now have a massive housing shortage, and people are being priced out and evicted, and people can't come back to the communities where they grew up, and people are living in cars. And that's what we're trying to correct. And specific to San Francisco, this is my city. I've been a San Francisco resident for 23 years. San Francisco, with all respect to our neighbors, is the best city on the planet, and I love it with all my heart. San Francisco has not done what it needs to do around housing. Yes, we have built housing, but considering the magnitude of the size of our city and our economic growth and all the jobs we've created, which is a good thing, a growing economy, we have not added enough housing. We have banned apartment buildings in about 70% of San Francisco. That is not sustainable. And our housing production, after we finally peaked for a few years at 4,000 or so units a year, we're now backsliding again. So San Francisco has done some really good things on housing, but it has not done nearly enough.
All right. Well, we'll see if this next caller agrees with your statement that San Francisco is the best city in the world. But we have Kate calling in from Richmond, not San Francisco. And Kate, welcome to City Visions. What's your question for Senator Wiener?
So this is a little bit kind of on Prop 13. I'm wondering, because I'm a firm believer that homeowners really contribute to community and building community, I'm wondering if there's any potential to look at revising Prop 13 so that tax cuts are only for primary residences, which would open up a lot of houses to the market so that people could move closer to where they work.
Thank you, Kate, for that question. So, yes, under Prop 13 right now, a second home, a vacation home, multiple homes would qualify for Prop 13. And there's potentially, I believe it's going to be on the ballot, a reform to Prop 13. And this is a major issue for housing production. So, Senator Wiener, your take on Prop 13.
Yeah, this is a tough one, but it's important that we're talking about it. Prop 13 creates significant anti-housing financial incentives for cities. Now, the measure that appears to be on its way to qualifying for the ballot in November, which I support, is the split role, schools and communities first. It will take large commercial property out of Prop 13, because when people adopted Prop 13 in 1978, I think people had in mind that they were trying to protect homeowners, particularly on fixed income, so that people didn't get priced out of their homes with increases in property taxes. I don't think most people were thinking of giving a property tax break to the Transamerica Pyramid or to other commercial buildings. And so this will take them out of Prop 13, will generate significant new funding, particularly for public education, and there's a broad coalition behind it, and I fully support it. On the residential side of Prop 13, the incentive Prop 13 creates for cities is to favor commercial development, because we make it really hard for cities to raise funding for critical services. We make it hard to raise taxes, hard to pass bonds, hard to do anything. And so cities are really struggling with their finances. And so if you're a city and you have a choice between commercial or residential development, you get capped property taxes. And then under commercial development, in addition to property taxes, you may get sales tax, you may get hotel tax, you might get business tax, you might get parking tax. There's a variety of other revenue sources. And so cities, who are struggling will favor or have an incentive to favor commercial development. And that is one of the factors that has suppressed housing production in California. Zoning is another one, but, it's always a multi-factor situation. I am not overly optimistic that the residential side of Prop 13 is going to be reformed anytime soon. Even the proposal for later this year, taking out large commercial buildings, which should not be controversial, does not pull off the charts. It is a winnable campaign if progressives and unions and others get behind it. But if you start trying to change the residential side, that's going to be hard politically. These are conversations we should have. Should Prop 13 apply to beyond a single home and so forth? Those are legitimate questions to ask and conversations to have. I'm just not overly optimistic that that will change in the near future.
All right. Well, and I should also put in a plug for our show next week, where we're going to be delving a bit into potential Prop 13 reform, particularly in terms of education funding. So if you're interested in the subject, please tune in next Monday night here at 7 o'clock KLW. And thank you, Kate, for that question. I want to let listeners know this is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the housing crisis in the Bay Area and beyond, and what the state legislative solutions are being proposed to try to address this crisis. And we're joined by Senator Scott Wiener, Democratic member of the California State Senate, representing the 11th District, which includes San Francisco and parts of San Mateo County. And he was prior to that a member of the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco. If you have questions for Senator Wiener, have ideas for what the state could be doing better to address the housing crisis in the Bay Area and beyond, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. Let's go back to our phone lines. We have Elon calling from Berkeley. So, Elon, if I'm pronouncing that right, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, hi there. My name's Elon. I grew up in San Francisco, and I went to UC Berkeley. And in college, I lived in a student co-op, which had anywhere from 20 to 60 people living in them. And what I'm wondering is, there are a lot of structural barriers to creating larger communal houses in the Bay Area. I know that, like we were talking about fourplexes earlier, but to me that just seems like such a low number. I know there's a huge demand for communal living that would be like 20 people, and I'm wondering, there are all these laws that don't allow people to build houses that have like 20 people in them.
All right. Well, that's a different type of housing product to bring up, and I appreciate you raising that question. So, Senator Wiener, yeah. Communal living, where is sure. that factoring into this?
Sure, and I think communal living is a great option, and there's a lot of zoning that prohibits it, essentially. I think it's for not for everyone, but for some people, it's a great option. It should be an option for people. And it can be a cheaper way to live as well. And it's also, a way to build community. But I don't think that that impacts how many people you can house. So whether you have, you know, if you have X amount of space, whether you have it as one large home with, you know, X number of bedrooms and people live one or two to a bedroom or whatever, versus you divide it into four units and you have, you know, one family or one group of people living in each unit, it's more or less housing the same amount of people. The issue is, you know, how tall are you allowed to build? How bulky are you allowed to be? Cities have, you know, setback requirements where, you know, they don't want people filling in the backyard or going all the way up to the lot line. And those are conversations we can have about what is optimal. Some people, you know, like height. I think it's okay to go a little taller. Some people really don't like height. But I think we should have communal living opportunities for people. But people sometimes like to have their own unit or for their family. And I think people should have those options. And that's really what SB 50 is about. It's about options. There's been a narrative, oh, this is about getting rid of single-family homes, which is not true, and SB 50 does not even allow for the demolition of single-family homes to build fourplexes. It's about giving people more options, single-family, fourplex, small apartment buildings, mid-sized apartment buildings. Let's have all of it so people can decide where they want to live, what kind of housing they want to live in, and have more cost options so that they can actually access the housing market.
All right. Well, thank you, Ilan, for asking that question. And Senator Wiener, I wanted to go back to this discussion about where Senate Bill 50, SB 50, is in the process. So you mentioned that, you know, we've got through this month to get the bill out of the state Senate. It looked like it was just passed out of the Senate Rules Committee and maybe going to the floor for a full vote by the state Senate. What's next politically for this bill? What are the big hurdles? What do you sort of predict is going to happen here?
Sure. So SB 50, it was passed by last year by two policy committees, the Senate Housing Committee and the Senate Governance and Finance Committee. And then it was placed in the Senate Appropriations Committee where it became a two-year bill. This month, we transferred it from the Appropriations Committee to the Rules Committee. This is a very winding path. And today the bill was withdrawn from the Rules Committee and it is now on the Senate floor. After tomorrow, it'll be eligible for a vote. But our deadline to pass it out of the Senate is the end of this week. And so that means that in order for it to pass out of the Senate, it has to receive a full Senate vote and get at least 21 votes on either Wednesday or Thursday of this week. So it's even though we've been at this for over 2 years now, we're now on a very compressed timeline. And so we will know by later this week whether SB 50 gets passed by the full Senate.
Do you think it's going to pass?
I think we have a path to getting it passed. It's not certain. It is, you know, there are definitely different opinions within the Senate, not surprisingly, reflecting, you know, the fact that there are different opinions in the community. I have colleagues who strongly support it, colleagues who don't support it, and colleagues, you know, who are in the middle. I'm not going to predict what's going to happen, but I will say we do have a shot at getting it out of the Senate.
And are you getting decent Republican support? I mean, one of the issues around this bill is the area that we're talking about for upzoning is very much concentrated in sort of Democratic strongholds across the state. It seems to me that a lot of Republicans, just thinking about their own narrow political interests, would probably prefer not to have some of these Democratic voters pushed out into these exurban areas, into the Central Valley, and turning some of these Republican districts blue, as we just saw in 2018 across California. So, and maybe ideologically they might support relieving some of the property rights restrictions a local government's place on property. So is there that bipartisan support that you're picking up?
What I've learned about housing policy in the 3 years that I've been in the Senate, what I've learned about statewide housing policy in the 3 years I've been in the Senate, among other things, is that housing is truly not a partisan issue. We have some deeply partisan issues we deal with in the legislature, and then there are other issues that aren't partisan. Housing is one of them, and so we find very odd mixes of votes. And so we have housing bills like SB 50 is strongly supported by some of the most left-wing members of the legislature, including members who are staunch Bernie Sanders supporters, people who are just left of left who are co-authoring SB 50. And then we have some really, really liberal Democrats who oppose it. We have some very conservative Republicans who support the bill and some very conservative Republicans who staunchly oppose the bill. We do have some Republican support. Most of my Republican colleagues are not supporting the bill, whether they're opposed or neutral. We do have a majority of the Democrats are supporting it, but it is one of those issues that it's just not, does not fall along any kind of partisan lines.
I mean, what about the governor in all this? You know, I opened the show talking about his $3.5 million housing goal. We don't even have enough land zoned for that in the state. Your bill would address that. I know he was very engaged in the tenant protection bill that passed, that you mentioned, that passed last year. Has he been engaged in this? Are you getting support from the governor's office? It seems like it should be a priority for him, according to his goals.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to speak for the governor at all. The governor has made a number of public statements that at least I've interpreted as positive about SB 50, going back to when he expressed that he wanted it, you know, had wished that it would have moved out of the Appropriations Committee last May. So he's made a number of statements like that. I know the governor is committed to a pro-housing agenda. We are in regular communications with the governor's staff. And they're very aware of what's happening, and will continue to work with the governor and his office for as long as this legislative process lasts.
All right. Well, we'll have to stay tuned on SB 50. I want to ask you about some other issues that relate to housing in the legislature this year. What about homelessness? What about related issue of these safe drug injection sites? I know there's been a lot of discussion and movement in Sacramento to try to do something about those related challenges. What should you commend to listeners to follow going on in the halls of Sacramento?
Of course, homelessness is fundamentally an issue of housing. So all the housing work that we do, you know, is designed over time to structurally fix this problem. So because right now we're effectively pushing middle-class people into what we would typically consider lower-income housing problems in terms of housing instability and overcrowding and having to live very far from where you work. And then we're pushing low-income people into homelessness. So it's just a bad situation. But putting that aside, we have been trying to make it easier and faster for cities to implement services for people who are homeless. I had authored legislation last year, which we were able to pass as part of the budget, to streamline and expedite approval of navigation centers, because it should not take a few years of fighting to get a navigation center open, whether it's on the Embarcadero or elsewhere. We need these resources so that homeless people can transition off the streets and get stabilized, and we need them yesterday. We've been significantly increasing funding for cities and for counties to expand services for homeless people, including supportive housing, navigation centers, mental health and addiction treatment, and so forth. We are trying to really take a hard look at mental health services in California, first to make sure that counties are spending the money that they have from the millionaires tax, because some of them are not. But also, I introduced legislation recently, along with Senator Jim Bell from San Jose, to require insurance companies to cover all medically necessary mental health and addiction care. Because right now, all too often, insurance companies will cover emergency mental health care. So when you're already in crisis and going to the psych emergency room, they'll cover that. But they won't cover the early intervention and preventative care. You know, because, you know, if someone is housed and has a job and has mental health or addiction challenges, we want them to get help then and get stabilized then, as opposed to losing your job and maybe becoming homeless and being in crisis. Well, then we'll help you. Once you're in crisis, we'll help you. That's a terrible system. And so we're trying to make sure people can get early treatment to address these issues. And then you mentioned safe injection sites. So I am partnering with Assemblymember Susan Eggman from the Stockton area to legalize safe injection sites. We had initially wanted to pilot it in a number of counties. There was a lot of political blowback for that, so we limited it to a pilot program in San Francisco, because we know that San Francisco is fully committed to it. Oakland has requested to be included, and I am fully supportive of including Oakland, but we just have to make sure that we have the votes. In 2018, and by the way, a safe injection site, for those who don't know, is instead of having people injecting on the streets or in parks or in other areas where it's not really sanitary and not good for the neighborhood, have a place where people can go inside, where it's safe and clean, and you have medical personnel there, clean needles, access to recovery services. And around the world, in Australia, Canada, Europe, they've been wildly successful. Infections go down, overdoses go down. There's never been an overdose death. Crime goes down in the surrounding area. Syringe litter goes down. So we want San Francisco, and I hope Oakland, to be able to pilot it. In 2018, we barely passed it out of both houses with the bare minimum number of votes, so it's a hard bill. And unfortunately, Jerry Brown vetoed it, so we're going to try again.
All right. Well, we're just almost out of time, but I have to ask you just one final question. I apologize. We had a couple of listeners who are trying to get in some more calls on SB 50, but we're out of time for them. But I'll just ask you this last one. We have a presidential election this year, as I'm sure everyone's well aware. On the issue of housing, any candidates stand out to you? And just 30 seconds or so for a response.
Sure. Well, I was a supporter of Kamala Harris, who I adore, until she dropped out. I'm now supporting Elizabeth Warren. And housing has been, you know, an issue in the presidential race for the first time in a long time. I do believe that Senator Elizabeth Warren has a fantastic housing plan, and it will, I think, be very, very effective.
All right. Well, I'm sure she has a plan for that, so listeners can go on her website. And for those who called in with SB 50 questions, you know, perhaps we can post them on the website and maybe relay them to Senator Wiener's office. And, of course, everyone's welcome to call their legislator and talk about the housing legislation that they would like to see put into place. But we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was Senator Scott Wiener, Democratic member of the California State Senate representing San Francisco and parts of San Mateo County. He's been with us this whole hour. Thank you so much, Senator Wiener, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, you can visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulip, and tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next week as we talk about how California can boost education funding for the students in this state. More of that Prop 13 discussion. So stay tuned, 7 o'clock Monday night next week for that show. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.